recorded at the Southwest Conference on Botanical Medicine in April of 2012. For more information on our conferences, lecture notes, and recordings, visit our website, botanicalmedicine.org.
You know, one thing that came up yesterday, I was in the car with David, and he was saying, hey, you know, you mentioned sea salt in your talk, and what's really the difference between sea salt and table salt, and, you know, what's, is there any data supporting it? And, you know, my response was, well, that, you know, sea salt, as it is, it's just salt from the ocean that's then, you know, you take the brine and then you just dehydrate the water and you're left with that salt there. What is it? Well, it's not just sodium and chloride. It's about 85% sodium chloride, turns out. And the rest of it's magnesium, calcium, and all kinds of other minerals that are in there. So it becomes a much more balanced, you know, salt formula rather than just a mined sodium chloride. Because sodium chloride from the mine is actually just a product of the compressed sodium and chloride over the long, long term. And it's pretty much separated out all the other minerals. They've all become their separate ionic compounds. So, I'm a big proponent of sea salt, and I'm trying to undo the idea that salt is bad for us and that salt is going to raise our blood pressure. If you notice, animals all over the world, they seek out salt. They'll go miles and miles and miles to find salt, and it's been a substance that we've fought wars over. It's essential to our function, and remember in your chemistry class that water follows salt. So instead of always telling people to drink more water, sometimes they need a little bit of salt, and their water will stick with them a lot better. That was just a little aside, and David's not here, so you'll have to get that from someone else. Okay, so I've got a couple little topics here. And one topic that keeps coming up in all my classes here has been the concept of agave syrup. And I'm sure a lot of you are already familiar with what's going on with agave, but I just wanted to just tell you what happened for me was that I was, you know, part of the kind of the co-op revolution, and, you know, I was a vegetarian for a long time, and I was always into what was the new and organic and good source of sugar. And it was before I really realized how detrimental sugar was, maybe 15 years ago. And then eventually agave hit the scene, and it was tastes good, and everybody's all about organic blue agave nectar. So, you know, a lot of people are saying, oh, but it's so much better, you know, blah, blah, blah. So I started researching it, and there's actually some really good data out on it. And if you just consider the fact that, you know, for birch syrup, for honey, for xylitol, you know, you can tap the tree or get it from the bees. You can't tap an agave tree and get agave syrup. It doesn't happen. It's actually six chemical steps to get you from the agave material to agave syrup. It's the same exact six steps that it takes to get from corn to corn syrup. So the only difference between corn syrup and agave is the flavor, and the fact that agave is 70% high fructose and corn syrup is only 55% high fructose. So that's the deal, and I've got some great data. If you want the research, if you want to be able to have it in your office, give it to your patients. I actually have it on my dietary handout in my clinic, just a little note about agave and a link so people can see that. Because a lot of people are making a lot of money off that product, and it tastes great, but it just needs to be, you know, an awareness of the fact that it's sugar. Okay, so a few things. Herbs and oncological agents. That's kind of my area of expertise. Working up in Oregon with Donald Yance for the last 6 years and Jonathan Treasure, Dr. Dwight McKee. We deal with cancer day in and day out. So herbs are our tools and oncology is the field. I want to talk about warfarin. It's one of those things that comes up all the time with my patients and with a lot of the people that call me to ask questions, a lot of doctors who consult with me and ask me, what do I do with my patient on warfarin? So I want to address that issue. I want to talk about aspirin and acetylation and the difference between salicylate-containing plants and aspirin. And we'll do that. And we'll also talk about St. John's wort, which is one of my favorite plants and one that, you know, is one of those poster childs now for herb-drug interactions. And we need to discuss it because there's a lot more to the story than what you hear in peer-reviewed articles. And then I want to get into the idea that there's some good research and some not-so-good research, and there's some good resource material that I want to share with you also. And if you haven't heard of the textbook that I'll bring up, then make sure that you get the information to get a hold of that textbook, especially as a naturopath, and we'll talk more about that. It's a herb, nutrient, and drug interactions textbook. So there it is. Starting with the first slide here, this is one of my mentors, a dear friend of mine, my godfather, Jonathan Treasure, who's a master herbalist trained in the UK. And this is what he says when we're having these kind of conversations, and I just quoted him off this out of one casual interaction, was that herb-drug interactions is what we do. So people are always wondering, you know, is there going to be an interaction? Well, of course there's going to be an interaction. And we want herb-drug interactions. The thing is, we don't know much about it yet. We don't know very much about herb-drug interactions. But we know that one herb in itself contains 500 and some compounds that are all interacting with each other. But herbs are a different beast, a different animal than pharmaceuticals. Pharmaceuticals have a chemical constituent that's isolated that has a very specific effect on physiology, whether it be the inhibition of one pathway, one particular receptor, or maybe it's a hormone or something that we're giving somebody that's a direct, it tells the body to do something. So herbs and drugs are very different things, and it's the interactive potential that we have that's really exciting to me in this field, is that if we could really get the resources together and do the research to discover how many incredibly wonderful and beneficial interactions there are between herbs and drugs, we could do a lot of great work for our patients that we're not doing now because we're afraid to combine the two together. Now, that said, there are some interactions that have been defined, and there are some things that we're clear about. And those are things that we all want to be familiar with, and we should definitely, you know what we're talking about. So this is the idea of synergy. So most of the interactions that we know about now, and remember, there's a lot of theoretical interactions that are described in the literature. You know, herb A affects pathway B, drug C affects pathway B, therefore herb A and drug C are going to conflict. Well, that's not good research. That's not good science. We know that herbs don't even function in the same manner in one context to the next. They are polychemical. They're polychemistry, every herb itself. And when you put together a formula, you might be combining thousands of compounds. We already have the traditional medicine background to know which herbs are safe, which herbs have potential toxicities. And also, those of us who study traditional medicine know how to apply those therapies to people based on their constitution. So how do we do that with drugs? Well, we're going to need to get a little bit deeper on our phenotyping of people, because drugs affect specific enzymatic pathways. We can understand through genetics which people can metabolize those drugs appropriately and which people can't. And we're going to talk about that as we get into this talk a little deeper. And I want to just open it up that you guys can ask questions along the way. I'm happy to field them along the way, but I'll also try and leave some time at the end. So some of my favorite synergists in the field of oncology: curcumin, we talked about this a whole bunch. Turmeric in particular, which is, you know, representative of the curcuminoids. There's about three of the main ones, four primary ones. Most people use three curcuminoids as a group. Designs for Health uses a product from Sabinsa in India that's called C3 curcumin, and it's about 80% the chief one, desferrioylmethane, and then there's two others that are also in about 20% concentration. And the idea is to give the active component of turmeric to give the patient the greatest benefit. And curcumin is one of the most researched herbs in the field of oncology right now. And I mentioned last night that at MD Anderson, which is the largest cancer center in America right now, they currently have over 1,000 patients taking curcumin in conjunction with chemotherapy. That didn't just come out of the blue. That came out of years and years of research by Dr. Bharat Agarwal from India, who's been working in this field for 40 years, and he has many, many papers published on the subject of curcuminoids and turmeric in the field of oncology. And what we know about that plant is that it both reduces toxicities and it also enhances the activities of most chemotherapies that we've used it with. And there's a lot of data, and there's human data. Green tea has an incredible history, super rich, and there's a lot of good epidemiological studies, human studies of patients in China drinking green tea. And then looking at patients over long periods of time, patients who drank lots of green tea had much lower risk of colon cancer, breast cancer, prostate cancer than people who didn't. That's just a simple study. It's not randomized, placebo-controlled clinical trial, but it's looking at, you know, doing questionnaires and asking people how much tea they're drinking over a long period of time and then assessing whether they have cancer or not. They're not the ultimate, they're not our evidence-based gold standard right now, but they're a great place to start, and there's been a lot more research now into green tea, and especially the individual components of green tea that make it up and that are some of the most powerful compounds we can use to help people going through chemotherapy treatment. It's also, all of these things on this list are incredible for preventing cancer, aside from maybe the melatonin, which I only use in people who need it. Resveratrol, we talked about. It's a compound that comes from from grape seed and skin. That's where I first discovered it. But it's highly concentrated in the herb Polygonum cuspidatum, the Japanese knotweed. It's a wonderful herb that I'm going to talk about a little bit further as we go a little deeper into this talk. Mushroom extracts, reishi mushroom, that's the Ganoderma lucidum, Poria coccus, the Coriolis versicolor, the turkey tail, local to Oregon. There's also the chaga mushroom. I was just telling someone today, betulinic acid grows on the Betula alba, the birch tree, and has this incredible compound it makes called betulinic acid. It's probably the most potent anti-melanoma compound that we have in our repertoire right now. But mushroom extracts are very well researched for their synergy. And it really bothers me because people think of them as these polysaccharide-rich compounds that have all these beta and alpha glucans in them that stimulate immune function. Well, I have yet to see a person who took mushroom extracts and started to see their white blood cells increasing out of the normal range. I've never seen a mushroom extract induce a change in a person's white blood cell physiology and their differential that made it look like their immune system was stimulated and they were going to have more autoimmune disease. It's not that simple. It's not like that. Mushroom extracts actually are modulating to the immune system. The beta glucans are used by the body. They don't tell the body what to do. That's a really important difference between drugs and plants. Melatonin, a lot of great research on its synergy with chemotherapeutic agents, has some research against melanoma as well. But mostly I use it in patients who have trouble with sleeping. They're not producing much of that. Their pineal gland isn't working properly. Their life rhythm isn't set. David was talking a lot about sleep and sleep deprivation, and also Paul Bergner today. Sleep debt in this country is a big deal. Melatonin can help some people. But most people, I use other things, actually. I use passion flower. I use glycine. I use theanine. I give them a formula with Zisyphus, Albizia, Avena sativa, herbs that calm the nervous system, verbena. But melatonin is good in some people, and if you're dosing it, there's a dream tolerance for a lot of people. That's kind of the main side effect, is that if you give people too much melatonin at one time, they'll get nightmares. It's a great indication that you need to lower the dose or they're not ready for melatonin. Panax ginseng, heard a lot about that already this weekend. You know, Panax means panacea. That's where the word came from. And there's a ginseng from every culture. The Panax ginseng or the red Korean ginseng is one that has a lot of great data on it in really helping people going through chemotherapy. And Paul did a nice job today talking about adaptogens and the dark side of adaptogens. And really what I got out of that talk was an herb like ginseng that's, you know, considered a stimulant. It's not a stimulant in the same way as caffeine is a stimulant, but it's a warming plant. It has a lot of invigorating energy and what's called the source chi of the body. It's one of the only plants that deals with the source chi, which is the first chi that comes out of the kidneys. Your essence is becoming energy in your body. That's where ginseng works, and it's really unique in that way. For people who have a lot of yang energy, it can be overstimulating for them. But for most people going through chemotherapy, radiation therapy, they're getting very depleted, and ginseng can really help support them through that therapy. And there's a lot of great synergy with ginseng and many chemotherapeutic agents, and you can see that research. I have tons of research. This computer is burdened by reams of research, so ask me if you want anything. Okay, some of the ways that we see mechanisms for synergy. Multi-drug resistance. You think about multi-drug resistance in the field of bacteriology, right? You're looking at MRSA. You're looking at ways that bacteria, pathogens, overcome drugs, antibiotics, by using a mechanism called multi-drug resistance. The primary way they do that is through something called the P-glycoprotein pump. And it's a pump that takes the toxin and pumps it out of the cell before it can damage the DNA. Cancer does the same thing. And cancer gets really clever about it. And that's why each time you give a person a chemotherapeutic agent, that cancer learns something if it survives. And then the next line of that cancer, the next mutated cell line, doesn't respond to that chemotherapy because it already figured out how to pump that chemo out faster than you could get it in. And four chemos down the road, the chances of you getting one that works is much lower than when you start with that first, the first option that you chose. So BCL2, that's B cell lymphoma protein 2. It's a resistance protein. We like to run this in everybody's tumor. Ask their oncologist, get a BCL2 level on this cancer. Let's find out if it's real resistant to chemotherapies. It's a good indication. But lots of plants downregulate BCL2. They do that in vitro and they do that in animals. Downregulation of inflammation, and we know that a lot of our plants are NF-kappa-beta. NF-kappa-beta is like the master switch for turning on genes that promote cancer. It's a big part of the disease process. So our plants do a great job of targeting NF-kappa-beta, and not many drugs do that. Most drugs are targeting, you know, the cyclooxygenase pathways or other aspects, TNF-alpha, like the drugs for Crohn's disease, like Enbrel. Induction of P10, phosphotensin analog, and P53, those are genes that suppress tumors. These get mutated under the influence of toxins, even toxic emotions. Living in the wrong environment for your genetic phenotype can lead to tumor suppression inhibition. That means that when there's an error in the genetic sequence as you're remodeling your chromatin, the stop measure, the checkpoint, doesn't turn on and say, red light, turn this one off. It's quiet. And the replication continues, and there's an error. That error then leads into further errors. That's the first part. You know, you get your anaplasia, metaplasia, neoplasia. That whole process is going to be inhibited in large part by these tumor suppressor genes. And many of our plants turn on and induce these suppressor genes. One of the big ones we have right now are the isothiocyanates, these sulfur-rich compounds from broccoli sprouts, from cabbage sprouts, from wasabi rhizome. Very rich, and they turn on P53, P10, things like olive oil, oleuropein. And these are simple things, and there's a lot you can do for your patients who are on certain drugs that have a resistance pathway associated with one of these tumor suppressor genes. For instance, I talked about last night, Herceptin. If Herceptin doesn't work, most of the time it's because P10 isn't on. If P10 turns back on, Herceptin will keep working. So you can keep Herceptin working for a long time in people if you give them the right stuff. I'm not going to go into that in detail right now. That's a whole other class, but that's the kind of work that I'm talking about doing with this, with the interactions. STAT1 and STAT3, these are transcription activators. Big piece of the cancer puzzle right now. And there's lots of plants we have that induce STAT1 and STAT3, or you know, they actually inhibit STAT1 and STAT3, which regulates cell differentiation. And then the last one here is HIF1, hypoxia-inducible factor 1. When cancer is trying to, first of all, once it gets bigger than 2 millimeters, the tumor is going to have to build its own blood vessels. Angiogenesis, right? Well, the call for angiogenesis comes from a hypoxic environment. And one of the main indicators that there's not enough oxygen in that area is something called hypoxia-inducible factor 1. When that gets into the bloodstream, the body asks for angiogenic signals from the bone marrow, vascular endothelial growth factor, and a number of other growth factors. Those are dumped into the bloodstream. The cancer grabs a hold of those and builds new blood vessels. HIF-1 induces that process. There are herbs that really nicely inhibit HIF-1. Mushroom extracts, the vitamin D inhibits HIF-1. Vitamin E succinate inhibits HIF-1. Digoxin, digitalis, our plant, digitalis, the foxglove, it oxygenates the body, it oxygenates the tissue. There's some really incredible research on digitalis and the digitoxin-like compounds and the reduction in HIF-1. This is a big trigger for angiogenesis. I want to talk about turmeric. Jianghuang, this is this yellow, amazing herb from Chinese medicine. Contains the sesquiterpenes, turmerone, and also the curcuminoids. Curcuminoids are the big ones in the cancer research, okay? In Chinese medicine, it's known as an herb that promotes blood circulation to dispel blood stasis, removes blood stagnation, promotes the circulation of qi, expels wind, and relieves wind damp pain. If you don't know Chinese medicine, it's maybe a little complicated. You don't get what that is necessarily. But this plant has a lot of actions and a lot of activities. It does a lot of things. And that's what I wanted to talk about, why I picked this plant. Because, first of all, there's a lot of research on this plant, which makes it easy to see how it works. But it's also a plant that exhibits the... It's kind of like the poster child for multitasking. And plants are multitaskers. They do many things simultaneously. That's because they've got lots of compounds. And each compound can be a multitasker. Each curcuminoid itself affects many different pathways. So the research coming out on these different pathways, you know, this is from Agarwal. I just want to show you guys an idea. This is a couple of years ago. This is 2008 now. God, it's getting old. But these are all the pathways that we know about now that curcumin positively influences with regard to cancer. That's one aspect of one plant. It's actually the curcuminoids. So those three curcuminoids. Look at that. It's amazing. And all these things are involved in cancer progression. So how do we influence them? So it's not going to hit cancer like a hammer. It's not a sledgehammer. This is more of a gentle action on many different aspects. Chemotherapy is more like a sledgehammer. One of my teachers told me, you know, if the only tool you got's a hammer, every problem starts to look like a nail. And so this is more like, you know, a set of many different screwdrivers, small ones, 7-star bits, you know, little square bits, little circular bits, and all kinds of things like that. And it does the work for you once it gets in there. Here are some of the cancers that curcumin has been shown to have positive influence on. It's pretty amazing. Melanoma, Melanoma is a hard one, especially, you know, don't mess around with cancers with your patients. You know, cervical cancer is an obvious one. You know, cervical cancer, once it's progressed, very hard to treat. Easy one to find. Easy one to get rid of early on. I have had not one patient with cervical dysplasia that I haven't been able to turn around. And that's probably a dozen women. Bone cancers, and that's both primary bone cancers and also metastatic cancers. You know, breast cancer has the estrogen receptor activity. Estrogen receptor beta is active on the bone. Estrogen receptor alpha is the receptor that's active in the breast and the ovary tissue and the uterus. But a lot of times cancer shifts over time, especially if you apply therapies. Remember, powerful therapies, those sledgehammers, they're a big ecological change. They put a big mutational challenge on the environment. So cancer then has to shift and shape. If you don't get the job done and get rid of the cancer, you've got a more aggressive mutated form. And it's always a complicated decision which way to go with these things. That's why this is so nice to have these tools, our tools of plants that are synergists. With radiation, I just wanted to give you this. I mean, these are just some of the studies that I have on curcumin sensitizing radiation, our tissues to radiation. And remember, radiation is another one of those things. Nobody really runs this test, but there is a way to test for radiation, whether it would be valuable in a certain tumor or not. I've had this argument with radiation oncologists over and over again. Carbonic anhydrase 9, which is involved in that hypoxia inducible factor 1, is an indication of how much oxygen is in a tissue or how much hypoxia is in a tissue. If you have a tumor that's very glycolytic, it's producing tons and tons of off gas of lactic acid, of ketones, it's very glycolytic, then that tumor is going to have a very low oxygen concentration in it. Well, how does radiation work? It's oxidation. Oxidation. What does that mean? It means that there's oxygen present. It means you're creating reactive oxygen species in the tissue to damage the cells and break them apart. If there's no oxygen in that tissue, you're not going to do a very good job using radiation as your tool. These plants will help get the tissue more oxygenated, and you'll have a better result with the radiation. There's only a few things that are sensitizers that you've got to be careful with. The only one is artemisinin, which we do use as a sensitizer, but its radiation sensitization is very powerful. So that if you're giving a person more than 150 milligrams of artemisinin, I always give the whole plant with it during radiation therapy, then that's as much as you can go. Don't go higher than that because you could get more radiation damage. The actual damage can be so strong that it actually damages the tissue more than the body can handle. Green tea with chemotherapy. A few of the actions. There's the inhibition of multi-drug resistance. And when you test a tumor, most of the patients that come to me, the first thing I want them to do is let's analyze the tumor in some way. Let's get a genetic panel that shows us what is this tumor made of. What is it made of? There's a great test called Target Now from Caris. And Caris actually has a foundation called the Clarity Foundation, which does free work for ovarian cancer patients. They offer their services. If you have a patient with ovarian cancer, they can send a tissue sample, a frozen tissue sample, on paraffin that's already in your pathology lab. You can send it to Caris through the Clarity Foundation for no charge. They will assess 87 genes related to the type of cancer that is. Remember, every cancer, ovarian cancer, is defined by the location. It doesn't mean that we know anything about it. It has tons of variations. Breast cancer, we're defining cancer by location. There are so many variations on types of breast cancer. That's what we want to find out. And find out if this is the type of cancer that we really need an aggressive approach or not. Inhibition of NF-kappa beta, that's that primary signaler. Upregulating cancer suppressor genes, P53 especially. P53 is like the main tumor suppressor gene. It signals to all these other tumor suppressors. It's really interesting. You can actually have people do a finger prick test for P53, for the protein in their body. And either the protein is functioning at a high level or a low level, and it may be mutated. Or it could be wild type. Wild type means it's on and it's working normally. Mutated means it's producing a protein that doesn't do its job anymore. So eating a poor diet in a poor environment over long periods can make your P53 make a mutated protein. It's not going to do its job anymore. We can actually test for that. There's it's kind of a long story. I'll get more in detail if you want that information. But every breast cancer patient should have P53. They should have Ki-67, a proliferation index, estrogen and progesterone receptors, the HER2 new gene, epidermal growth factor. They should have all those things run right off the bat. And there's a lot more to it than that. So epigallocatechin gallate, we all know that main compound in green tea. It's a great compound, but don't use it alone. The tea plant itself, you need the whole plant. EGCG above about 40% is all you want. You don't want 80% EGCG because all the polyphenols have activity. The theanine has activity. The caffeine has activity. The theophylline, the theobromine, all those things work together as a magic, this symphony. We don't want to take away all the parts and just leave EGCG. It's not as good. Theanine, wonderful, incredible for mood, incredible for inducing GABA, bringing up dopamine and serotonin levels. Really a great thing for kids with ADD and ADHD. I've found nothing that works as well as theanine. And it's got to be the sun theanine. It's the only one that actually has the potency. Polyphenols, flavonoids, and methylated xanthines. I just mentioned those. So here's some of the things that green tea targets. A lot of pathways. Activator protein 1, there's those signal transduction activators, NF-kappa beta, fibrinogen. We talked a lot yesterday about blood stagnation, about the fibrin formation in tumors, and the risk of every cancer patient is at 7 to 10 times the risk of having a clot, having a thromboembolic event as a normal person. Cancer loves stagnant blood, and it makes the blood stagnant. Compounds in green tea that inhibit multi-drug resistance, irinotecan and cisplatin, platinum drugs, they're helped by green tea. The green tea actually helps them work better. Beta-lactam antibiotics work better with green tea. Doxorubicin, one of the chief drugs, is called adriamycin. It's a first-line treatment, ACT therapy for breast cancer. And theanine itself reduces the excitation effects of caffeine. That's what it's in there for. So theanine is just a really wonderful and amazing compound. And it actually has been shown, some of the research shows that it induces alpha brainwaves, like meditation. And it's a wonderful meditative aid. And that's why the Taoists who first discovered green tea, the theanine was the part of it that focused your mind. The caffeine and the theophylline is the stimulating part of it. One interaction I wanted to just make you guys all aware of, especially as naturopaths working in this field, a patient comes to you with multiple myeloma, and they are taking a bunch of herbs and supplements. The doctor wants to put the patient on Velcade. Velcade's a proteasome inhibitor. It's one of the kind of cutting-edge drugs for multiple myeloma. Well, be careful. EGCG actually has a direct inhibitory effect on Velcade's activity. There's something called boronic acid. It's the main functional component of the Velcade molecule, and boronic acid will actually bond to the EGCG, and it loses its ability to inhibit proteasomes. That's important. This is one of the few herb-drug interactions we have that's actually negative. And the dosages in the study done in vitro and in animals were huge. You'd have to give a person probably 3 grams of green tea extract a day to get to those levels. So we really don't know what happens when a person takes a low dose. But it's something to be aware of and know that this is a real interaction. P-glycoprotein, I think I already kind of hit this for you guys pretty good. Some botanicals that inhibit multi-drug resistance. Another one there, I love this herb, Panax nodo ginseng. Are you guys familiar with that herb? The San Chi? It's a wonderful plant. It's a plant that was kind of mystifying Western science for a while because in Chinese medicine, we think of it as being, it's in the category of herbs that move the blood. Okay, so it breaks up blood stagnation. It inhibits sort of platelet aggregation and that kind of clotting cascade. But you know what? It's one of our best stop bleeding herbs. And on the battlefield, people carried San Chi. As a topical, you cover your wound with raw San Chi, and it's a styptic, amazing styptic. So people said, this is crazy. These traditional medicine people don't know what they're talking about. How could that possibly do that? So they looked inside of it. Well, what does it have? It has two main classes of ginsenosides. The one class, the RH class, helps clotting. The RG class inhibits clotting. Well, what do you know? Maybe the plant has some intelligence in it, and when we take it in the body, there's actually an interaction there where it can do what we want it to do and help us. Now, that said, I've had women come in who had menstrual cramps with a lot of blood stagnation. You give them San Chi, and the blood stagnation actually can get a little bit worse in the beginning, so you have to be a little bit careful with that plant. But just to say that there's a paradoxical action in many herbs. It's like the astragalus thing. People say, oh, Lyme disease, don't give astragalus in stage 4 Lyme disease because that's all, T2, TH2 modulated. And astragalus, upregulates TH1. But the research on astragalus upregulating the TH1 response was done in one certain context. And you can't take that plant and think, well, if we put it in this context, it'll do that again. We don't know that. So just be careful. A lot of this stuff is theoretical. Ganoderma lucidum, reishi, the lingzhi, the spirit mushroom. This is like one of our gifts to the world is that mushroom. the actual the Chinese character Ling is the character for spirit, and it's two people praying for rain under a tree. It's a really beautiful thing. That's a really wonderful plant, and there's tons of research on that plant. Prostate cancer, every prostate cancer patient, get them on reishi. Get them on a teaspoon a day. It inhibits something called transforming growth factor beta, among a million other things. But this plant is like really great for many, many people. It's a draining damp herb. It's a spleen tonic. It helps the kidneys. And then schisandra, we've talked a lot about this weekend. Schisandra has a lot of research coming out on it in animal studies and in vitro. Especially really working with chemotherapies to prevent them being toxic to the body and then also helping the people get better results. And there's a lot of studies coming out on that aspect of what we do. So most of the research that we have, especially the human studies, shows that there's a lot of positive synergy between these plants and these agents, the chemotherapeutic agents. Some more synergy with doxorubicin. Remember, doxorubicin is one of those drugs you're going to see a lot of. And Adriamycin is the big one. That's the first line, you know, ACT breast cancer regimen. But also Doxil. Doxil is the liposome pegylated form of Adriamycin. And that one's used in a lot of other cancers. But you get this really in severe hand and foot syndrome with a lot of people, half the people, where your kind of hands and feet start to peel and it's really painful. So using plants can help inhibit that. You know, quercetin is one of them. And quercetin is one of those things, again, that comes from a lot of our plants. So if you use the plants and then you add more quercetin to it, you're getting that enhanced effect like I was talking about in the panel last night. STAT3 by andrographolides. I mentioned that yesterday, too, the andrographis. Andrographolides have a really profound effect on NF-kappa-beta. Resveratrol and chemo. Nothing but positive stuff on resveratrol. Inhibits the BCL2 protein, that's a resistance protein. Tumor necrosis factor alpha, that's the target of Enbrel. That's the target of people with Crohn's disease. They block that tumor necrosis factor alpha and it reduces immune signaling. It's been amazing for some patients. I have a patient who was just crippled for 10 years, took Enbrel 10 years ago from his doctor, and he's been living a normal life. That drug for him was like a miracle because his life was so horrible before that. But plants don't tell the body you cannot use TNF-alpha anymore. Plants say, hey, there's some energy that we'll push, and maybe we can kind of help shut down TNF-alpha a little bit, and we'll move away. Maybe we can use some other pathways, you know. But they don't work in that same way. It's not like a sledgehammer. And induction of P10, tumor suppression. Resveratrol with taxanes. And taxanes are some of the main chemotherapeutic agents you're going to see. And do you guys know where they come from? The Pacific Yew. The Pacific Yew tree. Pacific Yew is a wonderful tree, and it grows a lot up in Oregon, and it's filled with these taxanes. There's some, I think about 28 taxanes that we know about, but there's three main drugs that we have that are taxanes. So when people get taxanes, they get either Taxol, Taxotere, or Abraxane, we will give them some of the Pacific Yew extract. And the synergy is really cool because Pacific Yew extract downregulates the multi-drug resistance proteins. Helps the stuff work a little bit better. It's the whole plant magic again coming in to influence the cell and the way that it functions to help make the drug actually work a little better. Okay, scientific validation. Rigorous control, analytically sensitive comprehensive chemical and biological fingerprinting. So we can produce in the botanical realm consistent batches of products. And that's really important. So whenever you're using products, don't assume that people did their homework. You got to do your homework. You got to dig, and you've got to make sure. A lot of people here are medicine makers, and I just want to I deeply appreciate that. It's so important to know where your medicine came from, know how it was prepared. There's a million ways to do it, and many of them are not, they don't produce the kind of potency that we need, and they don't produce the kind of clean product that we need as well. Okay, I want to talk about something that's coming out here. I added this slide. This is Bonjourlian, Scutellaria barbata. It's a Chinese herb. It's in the category of herbs to clear heat and toxins. It also eliminates stagnation, stops bleeding, and calms pain. It's a great herb. It's a little cold and bitter, liver and kidney. This just came out. This is Isaac Cohen doing this work originally. I looked this up, and it's called BZL100, Bonjourlian. BZL100. And now the name of it is called Beziel. They give it kind of a French twist, you know. It's becoming a pharmaceutical now. Phase 2 clinical trials, 16 U.S. clinical trial centers. In contrast to typical drug development, which separates an extract into its various components, Beziel is being tested with the hypothesis that the combination of components it contains would be more effective. That's pretty cool. They've actually done this. Now, they had 27 women who after it was an advanced breast cancer study, the women were all given an expected life expectancy of 90 to 120 days, and at the end of the trial, they evaluated 16 of those patients. Out of those, 27 of their total in the beginning, what did they start with? It says here, 6 of the 27 women showed stable disease, 3 of whom remained stable for 1,130 days, 836 days, and 594 days, respectively. Okay, that's the beginning. This is one plant just given to breast cancer patients, just randomized. Well, maybe it's not the best plant for those breast cancer patients, right? But it's just, you know, we're back to that idea that we're doing a clinical trial to find out if a plant works. Well, those of us who are plant medicine people, we know that plants work. They work. But we need to work. We need to know who to give the plant to, how much, and when. It's just like I was talking about ginger the other day. Why, you know, does ginger work for nausea? You guys, is there one cause of nausea? Are there more than one cause of nausea? Okay. So what if you had a person who had a really hot stomach with a hot ulcer? What about ginger? I mean, ginger is a hot herb. So if a part of your population of people who are being studied have a hot ulcer and you give them a hot therapy, what are you doing? Are you really testing whether ginger works? You're not really testing it. And so we can go a lot deeper, but I just want to put this up here because it's kind of the beginning of what I'm hoping will be more research in this direction. The problem is you can't research stuff unless you have money. You need lots and lots of money to do a randomized clinical trial. And the only people who are willing to put up the $5 million to do the trial are the people who stand to gain the $5 billion on 10 years of selling the drug. That's just the way it is. This is another herb that's being studied by a guy at Yale, PHY906. I know it as Huang Qin Tong. It's a very simple formula, 4 herbs. Scutellaria, that's you know, Huang Qin, the scoot. Peony, that's white peony. Licorice, and Sisyphus. Those 4 herbs. But you know what? Amazing results. For the first time, traditional Chinese medicine has demonstrated clear patient benefits through the rigorous testing of clinical trials. So this is an 1,800-year-old formula that decreases the gastrointestinal toxicity from CPT-11, that's irinotecan. That's phase 1 and 2 clinical study. And it did not alter the metabolism of the 5-FU and irinotecan through the body. So it didn't alter the way that the drug was metabolized. Yet it reduced the severity of the diarrhea associated with the chemotherapy. It's very important because that drug has a big dose-limiting diarrhea effect. You can have life-threatening diarrhea from that drug. I'll talk a little bit more about that and how we can help people with that. Also, you can see that it potently inhibited NF-kappa-beta, COX-2, and nitric oxide synthase. And in addition to that, it also has anti-tumor properties. And this is studying another form. So capecitabine or Zolota is the same thing as 5-FU, which if you get into the field of medicine and you start practicing, you're going to see cancer because it's the leading cause of death in this world. And why? Because we haven't figured out that we will never cure cancer unless we cure the way we live our lives. We're not going to find a cure for cancer. It's mutating faster than we can change our diet, faster than we can change the food sources and the medicines we have. It's a mutational change that's coming out of the way we are living. We are not doing it very well right now. And so it's showing, what are the 2 causes of disease? I mean, cancer? We are cancer, right? Uncontrolled growth. We're not considerate about our output. We're not burning fuels efficiently. Where we've got lots of waste. We're not recycling things, you know? There's so many levels that cancer is the manifestation internally of what we're doing externally. And the other big one is heart disease. Well, if you're not acting out of your heart starts to break, you know? And that comes back to lots of other factors. We've got the tobacco medicine that we've just taken to the extreme, and we're killing ourselves with that. We've got the sugar medicine, which we're killing ourselves with. So I just want to say that this formula is a very simple version of what we can do for people. And thankfully, someone's actually studying how it's working, and it's actually working great. Okay, that's my little bit. It's my little talk on oncology and herb-drug interactions. Any questions on that? Okay, so let's go on to warfarin. Yes? Yeah.
Yeah. Is that the same as the skullcap that we use for selling people down?
Nope, it's not. It's not. That's the Western The question was, is the scutellaria the same scutellaria that we use to calm people down in Western botanical medicine? It's not Bicol skullcap. It's not the skullcap that what you see, the lateral folia here. This is the Bicolensis that comes from China. It's like berberine rich. It's a berberine rich food plant, so it's very cold and bitter, and it's more for clearing toxins, clearing damp heat out of the body. Great for bacterial infections, anti-cancer. Tumor necrosis factor alpha inhibition. But again, remember, Crohn's disease is like a fire that just has so much fuel. It continues to burn. It's very hard to shut that down with something like resveratrol. It can help, but there's so many levels to that treatment, you know. And I was just saying that Enbrel is the exemplary TNF-alpha inhibitor. That's how it works, so, you know, in immune suppression. Okay, so warfarin, Coumadin. Just a little bit about the story. If you guys remember, it was a bunch of cows in Wisconsin that all got sick and died from bleeding. And they were like, what the heck is going on with this? Where did these cows die from? They couldn't figure it out and eventually realized that the sweet clover feed had gone funky. It was fungal. And they had gotten this really crazy yeast growing on it. And the main component of that yeast was this stuff called Coumadin. And so they said, wow, this is really incredible. It just, you know, it has this huge effect on bleeding. And they figured out that these cows were dying because they were no longer able to clot and prevent themselves from just bleeding out. So they started bleeding out all over the place and dying. So they said, okay, well, what can we do with this stuff? This is pretty cool. Well, we could kill rats with it. All right. So they developed this thing and made a drug, started killing rats and rodents by putting it out for them to eat as a rodent, you know, pesticide. Well, eventually, you know, we realized that, well, God, you know, what if we controlled the dose of this stuff? You know, and this is these guys in Wisconsin, and it was like the Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation, WARF. And then they called it Arin because it was based on the coumarins. And the coumarins are the compounds found in a lot of our blood invigorating plants. Angelica, Salvia miltiorhizome. They're rich in coumarins. Coumarins inhibit clotting to some degree and work with the body. This is a type of coumarin, but so they called it warfarin, this Wisconsin coumarin. But it's very potent, so we have to use it in a very low dosage. How does it work? It works by inhibiting vitamin K. It's actually considered a vitamin K antagonist. So it's good that we know that. But there's a few more things with that, because the thing is warfarin has a very narrow therapeutic index. Okay, the dosage has to be controlled really tightly. And we're not, like, you know, when you give people an herb, if you're an herbalist, you want to give them a formula, and you want to understand their constitution. So you give them herbs based on what you've determined about them. Well, you know, compounds are the same way. Warfarin is a drug, and if you could know something about the person before you gave it to them, you'd know a lot more about how to be safe in your administration, because up to 2.7% of people taking it have a major bleeding event, and many of them die every year. If we knew, and it's always this thing, oh, it's only 1 or 2%, you know. Only 1% of statin users get myelopathies. 1%? I don't care. If I'm that 1%, man, that drug is bad news. So we got to be careful. And so I think eventually we'll have some genetic testing for which people can do warfarin and which people can't. You know, and there's other versions of warfarin because it's metabolized in different ways to different people. The thing with it is that you've got the basic balance between clotting and hemorrhage, right? You don't want a person to have an embolic event. You don't want them to throw a clot in their brain or in their lungs and die from, you know, hypoxia. But at the same time, you really don't want them to have a hemorrhage. They're bleeding out in their brain or bleeding out of their lungs. It's even worse. And so a lot of people, you're trying to find that balance, you know. And as herbalists, you know, we're not testing people the way that people are, you know, being tested in the Western medical model. And so, you know, it's kind of an elaborate thing. And the main way that's being looked at is through this, you know, this international normalized ratio, the INR, which is based on the prothrombin time. Prothrombin time is this, you know, how long does it take for the blood to clot? It's about 10 to 13 seconds. That should be your normal range. So people are monitored weekly. People have a clotting issue, like a deep vein thrombosis, right? They've got clots, they're forming, and they're having pain in their legs, and they're getting a blockage. Okay, let's get them on warfarin. That's the approach. I don't like warfarin. I really don't like it. And there are people that suffer from lots of different side effects from that drug. And we don't know as much about it as we could. But we do know that it's a rat poison. We do know that it has severe effects. And we're trying to control it and play with it so that it's just at the right dosage for people. That's kind of scary. What do people do? They say, well, don't take any vitamin K. Don't eat any greens. Don't eat any broccoli. You know, stop all that stuff so that we can get a hold of your blood, you know, and get you healed. You know, we're going to get you so you don't have a heart attack. You don't have any clots thrown. I'm going, God, this is crazy. You're killing these people. You're taking away like some of their most precious nutritional food, their nutritional medicine. And you find now that the research actually backs up that people who take small amounts of vitamin K and eat greens, it's about 150 micrograms a day is what the research is based on, they actually get a more stable INR and PTT, and they're able to be followed more easily over time, and they don't have so many deficiencies. Because vitamin K deficiency is a big deal. It's a big deal. It leads to osteoporosis is one of the big ones, but it's going to inhibit the brain function. Vitamin K actually is also needed to prevent clots. That's the funny thing about it. But osteocalcin is a bone-building compound that also needs vitamin K. And if you don't have osteocalcin, your osteoporosis risk goes up a lot. So some of the side effects of vitamin K deficiency, bone fractures, calcification of arteries. You know, here you have a person who's really old, and they're not doing so well, and they've got, you know, some thicker blood, and so they put them on warfarin, and then pretty soon, what happens? You know, their bones start getting fragile because they're not being monitored for their vitamin K status, they're not eating enough greens, and suddenly, you know, grandma falls and breaks her hip. And now, you guys know how that story goes. So I like to find other options, but a lot of my patients end up on warfarin because that's what the doctor does. I just had a patient who's been with me 3 years, prostate cancer, incredible PSA of 2,900. Leg was this big when he came to me. Today his PSA is 21, but 3 weeks ago we almost lost him because his doctors had him on warfarin, and his hemoglobin dropped to 5.1. He bled out of somewhere. They didn't even know where. He's living in Michigan. I didn't see him. I hadn't seen him for weeks, and he just about died from warfarin. I was like, God, a drug. We think we can do better. So some of the things that do interact with warfarin, St. John's wort, I'm going to talk a lot about that plant as we go forward. Ginkgo. Ginkgo does have a pretty powerful effect on platelet aggregation. So know that ginkgo is something to just, you know, just be aware of. And hirudins, these are from the leech. The leech creates the hirudin. Hirudin is a heparin-like substance that the leech secretes into the body to prevent coagulation while it's sucking your blood. It's a little phlebotomist, and it needs to have its blood flowing smoothly. We use that as an herb, but now there's a bunch of different hirudins that are being manufactured. They're semi-synthetic because it's really hard to get enough leeches to get these compounds out of. It's in their salivary glands. Salvia miltea rhizome, I don't really worry about that one. There's some theoretical ideas that could interact. And then you've got the proteolytic enzymes, nattokinase, bromelain, and lumbrokinase. And the only one that I don't do with warfarin is lumbrokinase. The other ones I'm okay with. The question is, do any of the proteolytic enzymes weaken the blood vessels? And the answer is no. They actually work directly by inhibiting fibrinogen. They're thrombin inhibitors. They're actually kind of eating up the fibrin in the body, which is a nice thing. It's good because the thing is, as fibrin is getting eaten up, the body makes more. In my lecture yesterday, I talked a lot about blood stagnation and clotting and coagulation and hypercoagulation. The three tests that we always run on our cancer patients are fibrinogen, D-dimer, and plasminogen activator inhibitor 1. Get a good idea of what's going on in people. D-dimer is a peptide that's cleaved every time you break a clot. Fibrinogen is the precursor to fibrin. Thrombin activates fibrin and makes fibrin. So you've got these different pathways you can look at in a person's blood to see what's going on. And then you can alter them. And if you watch patients, and I've had at least 20, 30, I don't know how many patients I actually watched their fibrinogen and D-dimer level go from a high, dangerous level to a normal level just with lumbrokinase. That's my favorite enzyme for the work that I do. Caution versus contraindication.
What about Plavix?
Plavix is another sort of the platelet inhibitor. Yeah, I mean, you want to be a little bit cautious, and I think we'll talk about it a little bit when I talk about aspirin. Specifically, the effects on platelets with these plants are pretty minimal. And again, remember, plants specifically, they don't tell the body, no, you cannot do platelets anymore. This does not work anymore. They don't permanently end a platelet's activation. They don't do that. They influence the way things function. Caution versus contraindication. This is again, use caution with people. These are not contraindicated with warfarin. The most important thing with warfarin is to be in contact with the doctor who's administering the drug and who's doing the weekly or biweekly INR-PTT testing. Let them know, and the patient is the best way to communicate because the patient is the advocate. A strong advocate in the patient is the best way to communicate with the doctor and say, I don't want to be on warfarin anymore. I would like to step off of it. And the doctor's saying, okay, well, we just need to have your INR between 2 and 3 because you have a heart valve or something. Okay, great. So you start to bring in the plants that you want to use, the enzymes that you want to use, and every week you watch. And as that INR starts to slowly go down, then you can start reducing the dosage of warfarin. And that'll be the way to go. My concept is, let's use less rat poison and more medicines for people. It's that simple.
Radical,
exactly. I am a free radical. So just wanted to throw up there, cytochrome P450 2C9. This is how warfarin is hydroxylated. There's two different isomers of the conformations, S and R, doesn't really matter. anyway, these are the main pathways that warfarin is metabolized through. And then there is a phase 2 glucuronidation for warfarin as well. So, you know, people need to have that supported. They need to be glucuronidating really well. You need to keep their glutathione stores high. You need to have their phase 2 working well when they're on warfarin. And that's not a topic for this talk, but these are the pathways. And you can see CYP3A4, I mean, almost everything goes through that pathway, you know. When those pathways are used up, the body will use other pathways. You know what I'm talking about? Cytochrome P450s, you know, phase 1, right, oxidative breakdown of compounds in the body, take a toxin, something, a hormone, whatever, break it down. Okay? This is the way that it's metabolized. It's important because we're going to talk about St. John's wort. So aspirin. So I just want to talk about the difference between salicylate-containing plants and aspirin. And there's kind of an important difference. You probably know that, you know, salicylate-containing plants like the meadow sweet, the cottonwoods, cramp bark. Robert? Absolutely.
It can be real medical legal consequences.
Definitely.
If we advise our patients, these herbs to do this, you can back off on your Coumadin, they have to understand the risk that they're taking at the same time. And because if they have a stroke, you're cooked. You're the doctor.
Oh, yeah. No, I would never mess with someone's drugs. But the way I prefaced that was, talk to the patient. Make sure that you guys. Yeah, absolutely. And I'm not making any assumptions. My first point in that was talk to the patient, talk to the doctor. The doctor's involved. Everybody's on the same page. Some doctors will say, no, I'm not going to do that. I don't want to mess with it. I want the warfarin doses to be here. I don't want them eating any greens. Well, that's kind of an impasse at that point. Either then the patient has to find a new doctor who's willing to work with them, or they're just going to be on warfarin for a while. And it can be either way. So, but I try to make inroads, and especially a lot of patients come to me and say, hey, I don't want to be on this drug. And I say, okay, well, I'm not going to touch your drug dosage. Even though a lot of patients now are doing self-monitoring, it's actually the research shows that people who do self-monitoring are able to get their dosage much more accurate and there's less bleeding. But those patients still, if they're going to make any changes, and I have some people come to me and say, man, I messed with my dosage and now I'm dropping it down to here. I say, hey, if I'm going to get involved, I want to talk to your doctor. And I'll write the doctor a letter every time. And I'll say, look, this is what I want to do. These are the things I want to integrate. And most of the time, the doctor's like, great, let's do it. That's great, you know. I'd love to. We'll be very careful. We're going to keep following them week to week. But it's never a decision made by the CAM practitioner, for that matter. So plant-derived salicylates. The salicylates, you know, salicylic acid has been known for a long time. It's a great pain reducer. It's a COX inhibitor. It does a really nice job of reducing inflammation. It's great for fevers. We've known that. And that's what it does. Nowadays, we have aspirin. And aspirin was basically, they added an acetyl group to salicylic acid to create acetyl salicylic acid, right? Because salicylic acid, once it was extracted, it was really hard on the gut. And meadow sweet, which is high in salicylic acid, is actually a gut repair herb. So it's a little weird. You take that substance out and you isolate it, it becomes very hard on the stomach. And that's where the bleeding kind of came from, and people had irritation. So the acetyl group, the acetyl salicylic acid, created aspirin, which was gentler in that way. Now, the interesting thing, though, is that now what happens is the acetyl group actually causes an acetylation of the platelets, where the platelets actually are permanently disabled. They will no longer create the thromboxane that allows them to aggregate. So for the people that are taking aspirin every day to inhibit their chance of having an embolic event, they're just constantly turning off their platelets. Salicylate-containing plants don't do that. They don't have acetyl salicylic acid. So don't think when you're giving somebody a salicylate-containing plant that you're doing the same thing you're doing with aspirin. You're not. It doesn't do that. Okay? Is that clear for everybody? People often get confused about that, and they think that the salicylate-containing plants are going to have an impact on whether the drug is working, or they're going to prevent the person from having a stroke. They don't work in that way. They do influence the COX pathway, but not directly by deactivating the platelets. Okay, there's just there's a little image for you. There's the salicylic acid. You acetylate it, and you get aspirin. So St. John's wort. I love this topic. Centuries of use with this plant, and I'm going to go into my notes here. I had a couple things I want to make sure I hit there. Ellingwood talks about it for muscular bruises, deep soreness, painful body parts, throbbing in the body without fever, and preventing convulsions from spinal injury. And a lot of the indications for this plant are neurological. It's kind of like it's one of our best neurological repair plants. And Donnie actually kind of started calling it a neurological adaptogen, and there are no real neurological adaptogens outside of this. And, you know, after Paul's talk this morning, just the importance of using herbs, not based on a general category that they might fall into, like the adaptogens, but making sure you understand the plant, its energetics, how you use it and apply it. Keep it as St. John's wort, which is a neurologically directed plant. There's nothing like it for neurological pain, for neuropathic pain, people that do have neuropathies from treatments, people that have nerve damage from some trauma. Hypericum is incredible for that. It's the remedy. Meningitis, you guys. Meningitis. I give people teaspoon doses in meningitis, and I've seen it work wonders. One of the things it does is it has a profound effect on all three phases of hepatic detox. That's really cool. And there's a lot of data on that. And that's where the mystery comes in, and they're like, whoa, St. John's wort, let's watch out. Herb-drug interaction, you know, this is the big deal, because it's going to influence the way the metabolic pathways run. Is it an adaptogen? Well, there was a study that came out that said, you know, basically, it looked at mice that were running in the Barnes-Mays model, and it showed that if they were under stressful conditions, they were given corticosterone, that when they were given St. John's wort, they did a great job through the maze. They improved greatly when they had that stress, and they were given St. John's wort. So it shows that it's a stress-reducing plant. It has the capacity to help the body through stressful situations, which is sort of the underlying idea behind the adaptogens, you know. And I think that one of the things, if you weren't in Paul's talk today, the dark side of adaptogens, that was more sensational, I think, just to get people there. But the thing with adaptogens is that, you know, with patients that are deficient, you know, you've got people with chronic fatigue, adrenal burnout, whatever you want to call it, when you start giving them energy, they're going to want to go out and do stuff. That's the problem. As their coach, as their herbalist, as soon as they start feeling they're getting more energy, you tell them to chill out. Relax. Let's get some money in your bank account. You're already writing checks that are insufficient funds. You need to seriously get some backup energy. So you get them, and then 6 weeks later, 6 months later, then they're starting to push themselves a little bit back to a normal place, like mowing the lawn or whatever it is that they're doing. So just know that with adaptogens, we do need to be careful with that. You don't just give people adaptogens and then they're going to be great and they can go ahead and run. Oh, I feel better. Let's go. I'll go further. That's the classic thing with people with this chronic burnout. And it's a lot of adrenaline junkie kind of attitude in our society. It's like, I'm just going to run and run and run. Give me something that'll make me run further. Well, that's not healing you. You're just burning out more. So you definitely got to coach your patients to rest. But adaptogens are wonderful. They're very, very helpful. Antidepression. So we know that for depression, this is a great plant. Mild to moderate depression, right? Many benefits, positive neurological effects, inflammatory reduction. That's what I'm talking about. Meningitis, whether it's bacterial or viral, use this plant. It's amazing. If you need a little bit of aconite, gelsemium for people, that's great too. But those are drop doses. You need to know what you're doing. That this plant is very safe, and you can dose it in high doses for those people, and it is remarkable. I have lots of clinical experience with this plant. It also grows in Oregon all along the damaged roadsides and all where people have done logging. Whenever the earth is damaged, boom, St. John's wort comes up. It's really an interesting analogy. Hey, you guys aren't too bad. You know, yesterday it was like after lunch, everybody was just like, and I was working so hard. You know, now it's like you guys are like actually okay. Did you guys eat what did you guys have for lunch? Like, a lot of good, nutrient-dense food. What was it? All right. Seaweed salad. St. John's wort and other depressants, including SSRIs, provide support for St. John's wort's efficacy. And you've got two large meta-analyses showing that it's definitely more effective than placebo for treatment of mild to moderate depression and very little side effects. This is really important. It's great for mild to moderate depression. It really is. It's a wonderful plant for that. And remember, with plants, we need to make sure that we use them for what they're meant to be used for. For more major depression, St. John's wort is superior to placebo in patients with major depression. It's similarly effective as standard antidepressants and has much fewer side effects. This is a Cochrane review. Robert. Okay. So the question is, how do you know, let's say your patient comes to you and they've got depression, they're treating it with Lexapro or another SSRI, and they say, hey, I want to use some St. John's wort. And you say, okay, well, you know, we know that there's a real thing called serotonin syndrome. We don't really know all the causes, but we know that in some patients who have been taking an SSRI at a good dose, a therapeutic dose, and they're also taking a high dose 600 to 900 milligrams of St. John's wort extract a day. There have been some cases of somebody having serotonin syndrome. Lots of anxiety, racing heart, you know, heart rate 120, really intense situation. So what you do is you say, look, we can do this, but it has to be in a very concerted way. I want your doctor, your psychiatrist to know what you're up to, and we can start with a low dose of St. John's wort, and you can start to lower your dose of Lexapro. And if we do the two things together, at the bidding of your doctor, with you being the advocate, this works. You can get people off of their SSRI and onto St. John's wort. And some people do really well on the two together, lower doses. It just depends. But you don't want to go high dose Lexapro and just throw them on 900 milligrams of St. John's wort. There is a chance that something could go wrong.
Does it make a difference if you dose them at different times of day?
That's a good question. I think it would depend on the person. I like to do the St. John's wort in the morning. And I almost always combine it with N-acetyl tyrosine. That's one of the things that Donnie always taught me. One of the best things you can do is St. John's wort hypericum with N-acetyl tyrosine for depression. Great in children, too. And it's great in the morning for that dose, morning and afternoon. A lot of the herbs I do for tonifying, I'll do morning and noon, especially in adrenal rescue things, and then do more soothing, calming herbs at night because people still need to sleep. It's not a stimulant, though, this plant. It's a multitasker that helps the body get rid of toxins. And that's what it does in the damaged areas on the planet. It helps the planet recover from damage. That's why, you see its indication for spinal trauma, neurological damage. So this is a trial that came out from Bastyr, one of our wonderful, sister colleges of naturopathic medicine and Chinese medicine. Evaluated, the effect of hypericum on ADD and ADHD, right? And this is this trial was well published. Randomized clinical control data, very good, design. I saw this and I was thinking, God, what's going on here? There's some negative information coming out about, St. John's wort. Well, the first thing that stood out to me was that, I don't use St. John's wort for ADD. Do you guys use it for ADD and ADHD? It's not really used for that, is it? I told you that theanine. I use theanine. I like, some herbs, calming herbs, theanine with some glycine as an amino acid. Glycine's an incredible settler, really great for a lot of people. It's a very, very cheap, sweet-tasting, and non-toxic amino acid. Wonderful. But St. John's wort for ADD and ADHD? I don't know. I didn't quite know what was going on with the thing. So I dug a little deeper, and there's a number of, people involved. And one of the people involved in the study was a medical doctor called Joseph Biederman. And Joseph Biederman is listed in the, in the writing of the paper. He got the publication credits. So I looked in to see who he was. And I found him on a fraud site. And I'll read to you. Here's the article. Chief of the Program in Pediatric Psychopharmacology, Massachusetts General Hospital, Biederman, has received research funds from 15 pharmaceutical companies. The New York Times exposed how Biederman earned $1.6 million in consulting fees from drug makers between 2000 and 2007, but did not report all of this income to Harvard University officials. His marketing of the theory that children have bipolar was attributed to the increase in antipsychotic drug sales for pediatric use in the United States. Today, 2.5 million children. Following exposure of his conflicts, he stepped down from a number of industry-funded clinical trials. In March 2009, in newly released court documents, Biederman was reported to have promised drug maker Johnson & Johnson in advance that his studies on the antipsychotic drug risperidone would prove the drug to be effective when used on preschool-aged children. So I don't know. It's kind of beside the point, but... So St. John's wort regulates metabolic detox. It's so cool, you guys. It's a multitasker. It chooses pathways to induce. It induces these pathways of detoxification. What am I saying? I'm saying that when you have toxins in the body, this stuff helps you figure out which pathway it needs to go down and gets that enzyme going. One of the things that plants do really well is induce enzymes. That's why I don't do HRT with people. That's why not that I would anyway, but when people come to me and they're like, yeah, I'm on hormone replacement, I don't go to that place unless they've lost the gland. If they lost the thyroid gland, they're going to need thyroid hormone. Some people will need it eventually anyway. If people have lost the pancreas, well, they're probably going to need some insulin. If people have lost their beta islet cells, for that matter. If people have lost their ovaries at a young age, they might need some help. Not always. But so I try to use other ways because HRT follows whatever enzyme pathways are in your body, whichever ones are being utilized. So this plant is great because it'll help you metabolize things in appropriate ways. For, you know, take estrogen, for example. That compound can become so many metabolites. Some of them are very proliferative to cancer. We know that. Some of them are disease-causing, disease-advancing. And you don't know if you have a breast cancer. We know now that breast cancer probably started 10 years before it showed up as a 2-millimeter tumor. How do you know your patient doesn't have a breast cancer right now? And how do you know if you're giving them HRT without any support, without any direction? Where is that going? If they have a faulty enzyme, let's just take the example. They're drinking water out of a warm plastic bottle every day. That's a xenoestrogen. What's that doing? That's disrupting their estrogen metabolism via the liver. Now their regular estrogen, which is, you know, should be going into the 2-alpha hydroxylation position, is being hydroxylated at the 4 and the 16 position. Well, what does that mean? It means that they are more likely, in a major way, with tons of data backing it up, to have a breast cancer. That's serious to me. So be careful. St. John's wort tells the body how to get those things through the right pathways. It shows your body how to detox. This thing at the bottom, these are the main pathways that St. John's wort induces that we know about. 3A4, that's the one that grapefruit inhibits, right? 2D6, that's a really important one I want to talk about. 2C9, another one, lots of drugs through that pathway. And then something called the pregnane receptor X. And that's a co-activator for lots of other pathways. We don't know a lot about it, but we know that St. John's wort really gets it going, and it's part of its detox network. It's part of its helping deciding where things need to go to get out of the body. Because remember, if you break it at phase one and your phase two isn't working, you're stuck with the byproduct that shouldn't have been there. It never got conjugated. Now it's circulating. 17 keto metabolites of estrogen. You don't want those things. Robert. Is there any contraindication using St. John's wort in a patient that's been using lithium carb for bipolar? I don't know of any. Completely different mechanism. But I've got kids coming in on lithium carb on 1,500 milligrams a day, and I'm just like, oh man, really? Wow, you know, 1,500 milligrams of lithium carbonate. You know, Hans Nieper's work on lithium orotate is pretty fascinating. You know, 20 milligrams a day is pretty wonderful. And most of those kids, I try to help them get off of the carbonate by using some lithium orotate and then some St. John's wort and some N-acetyltyrosine and then a number of other plants that I bring in for that patient specifically. And then we can slowly get them off the lithium. But it takes time, you know. It's like once you get on that stuff, you're really on it, you know. And that's obviously not the root of the problem anyway. It's not a lithium deficiency. Three primary classes of specific drug interactions to be aware of. Drugs with a narrow therapeutic index, right? We talked about that. That's super important. It's really important. What are the main classes of those drugs? Anti-organ rejection drugs. Cyclosporin, methotrexate, no, I don't have to worry about that one so much. Cyclosporin for sure. I mean, if people are trying to prevent graft versus host disease, we don't want to deal with that. And because those drugs are going to run down some similar pathways that are activated and induced by St. John's wort, we could induce either the metabolic excretion of those drugs at a rate that we're not sure of how fast it's going, then they wouldn't get as much immune suppression, and then they could have a rejection of an organ. That's serious. We don't want to mess with that. Certain chemotherapeutic agents, such as CPT-11 or irinotecan, a topo 1 inhibitor, and when you do that target now test I mentioned, you'll find out if your tumor is using that topo 1. Anti-HIV drugs, right? Those are really important too. Very specific. Those are the non-nucleoside reverse transcriptase inhibitors. Those are really important, and what you can do is induce their metabolism to a rate that we can't really account for, and so you might not have enough of the drug around, and the virus might grab hold again. That would be bad. So these are the only cases, though, where you need to like really be serious about St. John's wort and its induction, because these are very narrow therapeutic index. The warfarin example is another one, but at least with warfarin, you're monitoring their INR and PTT, or your doctor is, either you are or their primary care physician, weekly or biweekly. And so that's how you can slowly work with them. One thing about the warfarin thing is if it's a consistent change that happens every week, they eat the same things every day, the same amount of vitamin K, they're on the same plant materials, it's not being varied, then you find a new balance point. You got a new INR, you got a new amount of warfarin. It's just, it's a real slow process, and it's got to be very open. One of the things that I do in my practice is I'm totally transparent to my patient and to every other practitioner I'm working with. I want them to know everything I'm doing. all the time. And if they don't care, well, then that's, you know, they don't have time, okay, but at least I'm being open with my information. So talking about one of the interesting, I wanted to say, you know, F-ups, but, you know, one of the things that have gotten really screwy in this thing, because drug-to-drug polypharmacy, you guys, that's the big stuff, and we don't know diddly about it. And, man, it's just unbelievable. When the body is told it can no longer do something, it has to figure out how to do it some other way. And that's where the genetics comes in. How do you do it when you weren't doing it the way that you're always doing it? HMG coenzyme A reductase inhibition. Well, how do you get cholesterol to all your hormones if the first step isn't there? Some people do it, and some people can't do it. So with this interesting interaction, people are saying, yeah, don't do St. John's wort, you know, with tamoxifen because it could interfere, you know. Okay, so for the last 10 years, it's been standard care for people to come in with tamoxifen side effects, right? What does tamoxifen do? It inhibits the estrogen receptor alpha, right? It blocks that receptor. It's a receptor antagonist. Okay, it's metabolized through a pathway called CYP2D6. Tamoxifen starts out as a prodrug and is metabolized to its metabolic active, which is endoxifen. Endoxifen is the active component that actually inhibits estrogen receptor alpha. Well, interestingly enough, is that SSRIs were prescribed for a lot of women for the side effects of not having that energy coming to your estrogen receptors. Hot flashes, night sweats, dry mucous membranes, irritability, insomnia. Right? You can't leave at this point. This is too interesting. It's too important. You can't walk out. Gotta wait. So, okay. So then the women are getting, you know, they get some benefit from it, right? Okay, I feel a little better. It's antidepressant. I'm feeling better about things. So kind of like I can tolerate this a little bit better. Okay, well, don't do St. John's wort and do these SSRIs, okay? Well, it turns out SSRIs inhibit CYP2D6 powerfully. How many women who got recurrent breast cancer were on an SSRI inhibitor and were never getting endoxifen? They never converted it because their SSRI was inhibiting the conversion. And what's amazing is that St. John's wort induces CYP2D6. Clearly, in the literature, it makes tamoxifen go into its changed endoxifen. The other thing is, of course, everybody's genetically different, and if you run everybody's CYP2D6, every woman who was thinking about going on tamoxifen, they could be a slow metabolizer, a normal metabolizer, an extensive metabolizer, or an ultra-rapid metabolizer. That's good information to have. Because if you give a person, everybody gets the same standard dose, doesn't matter, but I've got women who are ultra-rapid metabolizers, man, they are just miserable on the standard dose. And other women have no side effects from the standard dose because they don't convert it. But the research is all kind of still in this limbo zone, so we'll see what happens. But just one of these places, you know, there's a lot of mistakes that we're making out there. St. John's wort with CPT-11, irinotecan. Interesting. You can go now. Sorry, I didn't mean to single you out, you know. So this is pretty cool because I said about irinotecan, CPT-11, right? This drug has its main limitation in patients is whether it causes life-threatening diarrhea. And if you're one of those patients, it's a real bummer because you could literally die from your first dose of the drug. It's a small percentage. But again, small percentages, it still leaves some people dead. So there's a test we can run. It's called UGT1A1. It's a metabolic pathway that metabolizes irinotecan. If you don't have that, you could be the person who gets that result, life-threatening diarrhea. So I always want my patients to get that blood test done. It's not that hard to do. UGT1A1. Oncologists will say, well, no, we don't need to do that. You know, we're just going to give it to them. It's standard of care. You know, we're going to give the colon cancer patient FOLFIRI or whatever it is. So St. John's wort actually, in human studies, has reduced the side effects of diarrhea and the hematological deficiencies that happen. That's pretty cool. But at the same time, it also has some interesting effects that it actually can reduce the amount of the drug that's available. So because it induces the enzymes that metabolize irinotecan, the UGT1A1, it induces that through other pathways. It makes the drug more tolerable, but it also reduces the levels of the drug circulating. But it also has anti-cancer activity, St. John's wort. It actually has a modulation of cytokines. It inhibits and suppresses cancer. So what's really going on? Do you give them St. John's wort with irinotecan or not? Well, here's where we need to move forward with this research, is we need to find out how do we combine these things. Because I bet you there's some real great wisdom in there. There's a way to combine them. Because a lot of people come into us with a cancer that's it's really advanced. That cancer's got momentum, you guys. It's got a lot of momentum. It's pulling a lot of energy. It's really hard to get herbs that are going to turn it around. I don't tell people to go down to Gersten and do six months of just juice fasting. I've lost patients that way, seriously. It's not always a cure. Those, you know, all the great cancer heroes, you've got your Gerson, your Hulda Clark, you've got your Kelly, your Nick Gonzalez, the list goes on and on. 5 to 15% success rate with stage 4 cancer. 5 to 15% of those people that do those therapies actually get a cure. Is that your life gamble, you know? And there's a lot to it. I mean, we should be studying the placebo effect. We should be studying the placebo effect. It's incredible medicine. Some people have a connection with the doctor. There's a chi exchange. If something happens, it works. But I wouldn't bet my life on it. So we want to try and get specific. Use plants, the right amount of drugs. My point is that when your cancer is advanced and it's all over your body, it's got momentum. And we've got to hit it hard at that point. That's where a lot of patients come to me and say, hey, I've got this breast tumor. And I'm like, oh, my God. And they're like, I don't want to do anything. Well, do you want to live or you want to die? I want to live. Okay, that's good. Because if you want to die, I understand. I'll be there with you. We'll walk that road together. I'll, you know, whatever. I'll counsel with you. I'll do anything. But if you want to live, my plants just aren't strong enough. We're going to need to find out. Let's get a biopsy. There's in vitro testing. There's genetic testing. There's lots of ways to get more specific. Let's get an oncologist who's going to work with us. Then we can, you know, like I said, we can make those chemos work better. We can protect you. Let's try to give you a chance here at getting this thing done. So I often end up being the guide towards chemotherapy because people come to me in such, you know, just terrible states. And here I'm talking about prevention. I mean, I wish these people were coming to me 10 years ago. You know, come to me 10 years ago. We worked this out. You won't get cancer, hopefully. You know, in China, the best doctors have nobody in their practice. They're all at home. They're all well. You know, the whole village is at home well. You know, if you've got a busy practice, you're screwing up. So St. John's wort, you know, inhibits the toxicities, but then it also has some interesting things here. You know, protects against the intestinal toxicities induced by irinotecan, but it's also inhibiting some of the inflammatory cytokines, and it's inhibiting some apoptosis too. So it's blocking some of the effect of the drug. That's why I was saying it's important to just be aware of these interactions. And if you're not an expert on it, you're not going to study it, work with somebody who is. Camptotheca acuminata, that's the source. That's the happy tree, the cancer tree, the source of our camptothecans. Those are the herb, those are the plant basis for irinotecan and the camptotheca drugs, the topoisomerase inhibitors. Just want to put that up for you. We use this plant with those drugs. Yes. Okay. I generally use a differential diagnosis. Yes, absolutely. Sorry. The question is, how do you treat patients who are suffering from the side effects of tamoxifen? And the answer is, I normally use a differential diagnosis and treat them with, you know, formulas, plant formulas. I do some other things as well, but that's the primary way I treat them. And you know, the whole phytoestrogen debate is a long one, and I can't get into it with you guys right now. But you know, a lot of doctors out there are saying, well, if there's plants that have compounds that look like estrogen, don't do them. That's not the way I see it. All of those plants in all their research have shown to have anti-cancer activity. Again, we're at this place. We don't know enough. But you don't act out of fear. Act out of caution and intelligence and make the right, you know, just the best decisions we can. This is the textbook I want to tell you guys about, Herb, Nutrient, and Drug Interactions. It's a 900-plus page textbook that is a review of all the data we have right now on 30 of the primary botanicals, many of the nutrients out there, how they interact with drugs. This should be in every naturopathic college. Jonathan Treasure is one of the authors. Dwight McKee, he's one of the most brilliant minds in the field of medicine I've come across. He's practiced 40 years as an oncologist, hematologist. Now he just does consultations, and I work on a lot of patients simultaneously with him where we work together. It's really great synergy. And Mitch Dargo, one of my teachers at OCOM in Portland. So it looks at a lot of the research and gives a real thorough analysis of the research quality. Because a lot of the research that you're getting is actually peer-reviewed, and it's just, you're getting this little synthesis of the stuff. You're not actually, you know, if you want to know about what happens with soy and soy isoflavones, you got to dig. And you know what? It's a big dig. There's a lot out there, and there's a big discrepancy. But what is it? Is it good? Is it bad? Is it going to promote cancer? Is it going to not promote cancer? Is it going to help? Is it going to, it's going to help your bones? Is it, you know, there's so much. It's hard to know. So don't just take things for face value. And if you just don't know, like, I just don't know. I don't give people soy. I just don't really use soy very much, you know. I'm a Tim Francis Applied Kinesiology School. We do the, you know, if people are seriously sick, no sugar, no wheat, no dairy, no corn, no soy, no nuts, no seeds, no chips, no popcorn, no cocoa, no caffeine, no alcohol, no nicotine. Just simple like that. Pull those things out. You guys got that? Okay. So it's one of Tim's tricks. He loves that. Evaluating the strength of the hypothesis is really important, though. Is this coming from somebody's theoretical extrapolation, or did they actually study this? Do they know this? Types of data. I hit this last night. In vitro studies. And you know what should be on here is the first study, which is really the most important one, is did people use this plant way back? Does this have thousands of years of history? If it does, let's not mistrust ourselves, okay? This is our information. These are doctors caring for their families. Famines come through. They lose their families. Flus come through. They lose their families. These people are passionately trying to figure out how to save the lives of those that they love. Do we discredit that information? Why do we mistrust ourselves? Let's start with that information, you know. There's so many therapies we use. So many of these herbs are anti-cancer herbs. They've been used against tumors forever. It doesn't mean that suddenly now they're going to promote cancer because we're using tamoxifen. I don't buy it. Human trials. Obviously, these are really important. Phase 1, 2, and 3. Phase 1 evaluates whether this stuff is okay for humans to take or not. People are coming to me, they said, oh man, I'm done. My oncologist says they've got this phase 1 trial. I really want to, I'm just going to go do it. Oh, you're going to go do a phase 1 trial. Wow. Rather than do what I'm telling you to do, you know. I'd rather just take herbs. You're going to go try some drug. We don't know. We don't know what the dosage should be. We don't know how long it'll be. You know, we're hoping it might have some activities based on our, you know, animal studies and what we think about it. Man, that's a gamble, you know, and it really can be ugly. So phase 1 trials, I don't like my patients to go that way. Phase 2 trials, we've got an idea of what the side effects are. We want to get more information. Phase 3, we're actually going to see the outcome. And then that's what's going to get this drug approved for FDA approval for maybe, you know, breast cancer or, you know, what another condition. Epidemiological studies. These are studies that look back. You know, you look at the natural history of a disease, you ask questions about, you have people's lives, you understand how they did it over time, and you gather that data from people's questionnaires or things like that. That data is also good. It's more of a guiding force for us, but I still like that data. You know, I think it's good data in the right context. And the thing about evidence-based medicine, folks, is it doesn't say, the definition of evidence-based medicine does not say the proper performance of a randomized placebo-controlled clinical trial. That's not the deal. Evidence-based medicine is based on the best available evidence, okay? The best available evidence. Traditional usage. What kind of modern research is there? Is it good research? Is it not? And then clinical experience from the clinicians we know and trust, our teachers, our own clinical experience. That's it. Thank you.